Welcome to Animal Companions. This is Joyce, your radio reading service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading another chapter in The Case of the Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Gardner, and if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles and newsletters about the animals in our lives. I'm going to begin reading Earl Stanley Gardner's The Case of the Careless Kitten. In the last chapter, we learned that Helen had decided to tell Uncle George about Uncle Franklin's calling her while they were at the veterinary clinic. Both the information about Uncle Franklin and the poisoning of the kitten had upset and surprised Uncle George. Though he thought Helen's story about Uncle Franklin was a bit hokey, he decided to accept it and to go along with having Helen talk to Perry Mason. Chapter 3. George Alber was coming down the steps. If he looked as much like his father as Uncle Gerald said he did, Helen thought it was easy enough to believe that 20-odd years ago, Aunt Matilda and plenty of other women probably had fallen hard for Stephen Alper. They would have been kind as women, though, the ones who lose their heart to photographs of motion picture actors. Retouched photographs, Helen told herself. There was something of that artificial quality about George Alber's handsomeness, as if some careful pencil had drawn the Greek straightness of the nose, given the eyebrows that precisely perfect line, sketched a little extra wave into that thick, brightly dark hair. But the retoucher hadn't quite enough paints on the mouth. It was too full-lipped, and the jaw was too prominent. They marred the picture a little, that chin and mouth. They fed the coarseness into it, and vanity, and a kind of ruthlessness that might easily be cruel. "What's this about the kittens going mad?" His voice was something like his face. Helen told herself, retouched, so that instead of being just right, it was just a little too right to be real. "The cook says it scratched you. Let's see that hand." He reached for it. His fingers were long and strong and beautifully kept, but Helen didn't like their touch. She jerked her hand away. "My hand's all right." And Amber Eyes wasn't mad. "You can't afford to take that for granted," he wagged his head. "From what the cook says..." "The cook got her information secondhand from Aunt Matilda," Helen interrupted. "The kitten was poisoned." "Poisoned?" Albert exclaimed. "That's right. You're certain?" "Absolutely. But I can't understand that." Gerald Shaw, opening the left-hand car door and sliding out from behind the steering wheel, said dryly, "There's no particular reason why you shouldn't be able to understand it. Pellets of poison were embedded in several particles of meat and fed to the animal by someone who wanted to make every very thought of job of killing the kitten. I don't know how I can explain it to you any more plainly." George Alber apparently failed to notice the sarcasm. He said, smiling, "I didn't mean that I couldn't understand what happened. I can't understand why." Gerald said, "The answer's obvious. Someone wanted the kitten out of the way." "But why?" George Alber persisted. It was that question which suddenly impressed Helen. She turned to her uncle. Her forehead puckered into a frown. "Yes, Uncle Gerald, why should anyone want to poison Amber Eyes?" Gerald Shaw dismissed the subject, rather brusquely, Helen thought. "You can't account for the psychology of an animal poisoner. People go along and drop poisoned bits of meat into yards. The veterinary says they're rather prevalent in certain sections of the city." Helen watched George Alber's eyes lock with those of her uncle. There was, she realized, a certain innate combativeness about the younger man which made him advance under fire rather than retreat. "I doubt very much if the kitten could have been poisoned in that way," he said. "One scrap of meat, perhaps, yes, but several scraps? Well, I doubt it." Gerald Shaw, on the defensive and somewhat nettled by finding himself in that position, said, "Several scraps of meat might have been tossed into the yard with any space of a few feet. I see no reason why the kitten couldn't pick them up." George Alber turned back to Helen. When was the kitten out last, Helen? She said, I don't know, George. I can't remember that it went out after 3 o'clock. Could it have picked up the poison then? The veterinary says that it must have been administered within a few minutes of the time of the first spasm, not very long before we got to the hospital. That's all that saved the kitten's life. Albert nodded slowly, as though that merely confirmed some idea which he had in mind all along. Then suddenly he said, Well, I'll be on my way. I only dropped in. Be seeing you later. Sorry about Amber Eyes. Take good care of him. We will, Helen said. We're going to take Tom Lunk. Keep him for a few days. George Albert walked across to curb where his car was parked, jumped in, and drove away. Gerald Shore said with an intensity of feeling which came as somewhat of a surprise to his niece, I definitely and distinctly dislike that man. Why, Uncle Gerald? I don't know. He's too damned assured. You can take it in an older man, but what the devil has he done to warrant his assuming such a cocksure air? How does it happen he isn't in the army? Defective hearing in his left ear, Helen explained. Haven't you ever noticed he always turns so his right side is toward you? Gerald snorted. It's his profile. Notice the way he holds his head, trying to ape the pose of some matinee idol in the pictures. No, he isn't, Uncle Gerald. That's unfair. It's on account of his hearing. I know that for a fact. He tried to enlist. Gerald Shore was abruptly asking, When does Jerry Templar go back to camp? Monday. Helen tried not to think how near Monday was. Does he know where they're sending him? If he does, he isn't telling. They were at the door of the house. Gerald pushed it open for her, but he didn't follow her in. I've got some things to see uptown. You'll have to get down to Mason's office on your own. He glanced at his watch. You'll have to start pretty soon, too, and you won't be back in time for dinner, so you'd better say you're having it with me. That'll satisfy Matilda and let you give Mason all the time he wants. He'll want plenty unless I miss my guess. And I'll be waiting for you outside the castle gate at 9. He shut the door before Helen could remind him again that Uncle Franklin had very positively told her that nobody except Perry Mason was even to know about the appointment at the castle gate. Chapter 4. Perry Mason had the peculiar confidence-inspiring magnetism which is so frequently found in tall men. In repose, his features and his manner had the weathered patience of hard granite. It was only in times of stress that his irrepressible personality floated through. Before a jury, for instance, he could summon the skill and the grace of a finished actor. His voice was as responsive as an instrument that accompanied and emphasized his words. His questions held a razor-edged sharpness which cut through the clumsy falsehoods of sullen, stubborn perjurers. In critical courtroom crises, he was a fast-moving, quick-thinking force molding men's minds, playing on their emotions, outthinking his antagonists, dramatic, persuasive, agile, yet never forsaking the fortress of deadly logic, which buttressed every contention. Della Street, Mason's secretary, unlocked the door of the lawyer's private office and entered to find Mason seated in the swivel chair back of his desk, his long legs elevated, the ankles crossed on the corner of the big desk. Well, here I am, she announced, taking off her gloves and slipping out of her coat. Mason said nothing until she emerged from the cloak closet, having deposited her hat and coat. Then he said, Della, virtue has been rewarded. I told you this morning that we shouldn't clutter up our minds with the equity case, even if it was money in it. 8 hours later, we get this. There was a $10,000 fee in that equity case, Della said frostily. What's in this? Mason grinned. It's an adventure that will make you feel 10 years younger. Most of your cases make me feel 10 years older. Mason ignored her. This has none of the dull, routine angles that drives me to drink. It sparkles with bizarre mystery, adventure, romance. To put it another way, it's cockeyed crazy and doesn't make any sense at all. One hell of a swell case. So I gathered when you telephoned, she observed, crossing over to seat herself on the opposite corner of the desk, conscious of that peculiar gleam in his eye, which came only in moments of inner excitement. Perry Mason had the rare ability to so seldom found in professional men to derive enjoyment from his work. After a certain period, the doctor who has run the gamut of experiences of human illnesses acquires a certain impersonal efficacy and efficiency. He regards the patients not so much as persons as depositories of various symptoms or an anatomical structure which is to be coaxed or carved back to health. The lawyer, having acquired a sufficient background of experience, is apt to become imbued with the mechanics of procedure. But Perry Mason had a mind which was only content when it was detouring the technicalities of legal red tape. He not only regarded each case as a venture studded with excitement, but became impatient with the delays of routine procedure. More and more as his practice developed, he became interested in personalities. More and more his methods became dazzling, brilliant, increasingly dangerous, and highly unorthodox. And Della Street knew this peculiar light in his eye meant that this new case he had found a tantalizing puzzle. Perry was staring at her automatically. Della looked at herself through his eyes. Her brown suede pumps were good. Her legs were perfect. If the beige tailored suit didn't fit, it was not because she hadn't been so good as a tailor herself. Her face was all right, and she had a new shade of lipstick. Her hat was outrageous. She hoped he was satisfied. Della, Payson sighed. Sometimes I think you are getting blasé. Yes? She drawled ominously. Do tell me about it. You're getting conservative, mercenary, cautious. You're more interested in periods than you are in question marks. Della relaxed. Someone around this office has to be practical, but if it's not too much to ask, what's all the excitement about? I don't mind leaving half a good dinner uneaten and rushing over here, but I would like to know which missionary ate the cannibal. It was after you'd left the office. I was getting ready to leave, doing some work on that brief in the Johnson case. A lawyer whom I know slightly telephoned and wanted an appointment for his niece, and a little later she came in and talked to me. Della Street slipped from the desk to pick up a notebook from her desk. She drew up a chair and in her informal manner gave place to secretarial efficiency. What were their names? Gerald Shores, the lawyer, has an office in the Deventer Investment Building. As I remember it, he handles rather a specialized branch of practice, does a good deal with the mining corporations. Think he's something of a gambler himself, does work largely for promoters, and takes fees partially in cash and partially in stocks in the companies he organizes. Any money in it? Della asked. Don't be so damned mercenary. I think he makes more out of it than money. How do you mean? He's always chasing mirages. Our realistic philosophers hold that as being poor economy, simply because a mirage has no definite substance. They overlook the fact that it's such a lovely object to chase. They also lose sight of the fact that the mirage chaser is getting great company and great joy out of it in life. He's always interested in what he's chasing, which is more than you can say of many men who struggle toward more practical goals. Interest in life is the very best form of wealth. Any retainer? Not yet, Mason admitted. I see. The niece's name? Helen Kendall. Age? About 24. Very exciting, violent eyes. On the blonde side, nice chassis, nice assembly, nice accessories. Definitely nice. And no retainer? Della muttered. You say she's a niece of Gerald Shore? Yes. I'll give you a brief sketch of the family history. He reached for some scrawled notes and began to dictate, swiftly and compactly, the salient facts in the case went into Della Street's notebook. On January evening in 1932, Franklin Shore, then 57 and in vigorous health, went into his study after dining with his wife. There he received a caller whom he must have admitted himself, since no servant had answered the door. A maid had seen somebody coming up the drive, and thought she recognized him as Gerald Shore and Matilda Shore, also thought that the voice she heard in the study was Gerald's, but she had not heard it clearly enough to be sure, and Gerald himself denied having been there. Whoever the visitor was, he wanted money. Matilda Shore distinctly heard her husband's voice, lifted in anger, refusing to lend it, saying something about the world's being crowded with jackasses who only needed a few thousand to get back on Easy Street, even when a jackass ought to know that there's never going to be any such street again. That was all of the talk Matilda Shore overheard. She went upstairs to read in bed and didn't hear the visitor leave. She did not find out until the next morning that Franklin Shore had also left. Those were the days when a whisper could break a bank, so that Shore's wife and business associate did not take the police into the confidence until Shore had been missing for some days. Every effort, official and private, was thereafter made to locate him, but no trace of him could be found. The bank's affairs proved to be in perfect order, so that in spite of the headlines, the institution suffered no damage from its president's disappearance. His own affairs were also in order, and instead of explaining his action that made it more mysterious, because except for a few hundred dollars he habitually carried with him, he had apparently left without funds. His checkbook was found on his desk, with the date on the blank check filled in, and a broken line indicating that he had begun to write the name of a payee, and then, evidently, either changed his mind or had been interrupted. The book showed a balance of $58,941.13 in his joint account with his wife, and this balance proved correct except for one check for $10,000 drawn on a blank taken from another checkbook, about which Shore had telephoned his secretary before the disappearance. There were usual whispers several times during the few months before he vanished. Shore had been seen with a woman unknown to say any of those who reported having seen the pair, but good-looking, noticeably well-dressed, and somewhere in the 30s. But there was nothing to suggest that she had left in Shore's company, except for a picture postcard from Miami, Florida, postmarked June 5, 1932. Which his niece has received 6 months after his disappearance. The message in handwriting, identified by experts as unmistakably that of Franklin Shore, read, "No idea how much longer we shall be here, but we're enjoying the mild climate and, believe it or not, swimming. With lots of love, your Uncle Franklin." The plural pronouns, of course, seemed to justify the whispers about the blonde unknown, but the investigators who were hurrying to Miami found no trace of Franklin Shore. He had a number of acquaintances there, and the fact that none of them had seen him argued that he could not have made any long stay. His will was found. It left the bulk of his estate to his wife, with $20,000 legacies to his niece and brother. "How about them?" Della Street looked up hopefully from her book. "They haven't been paid. The niece has been living with her aunt for years. Gerald Shore has, I think, had some indirect benefits, but the legacies are still payable, and that is, they will be if Franklin Shore is dead. But nothing has been found or heard from him." "That's just the point. Something has. He telephoned his niece today. She's to meet him tonight. He insisted that I be present at the interview. I'm going to take you along. Do I take a notebook?" "By all means, a notebook. We're going to have notes, so we'll know everything that's said and be able to discuss the significance of things that aren't said. But why doesn't he get in touch with his wife and come back home?" "That's just the point. There was something mysterious about his disappearance. Some talk at the time of his having run away with a younger woman. Apparently, he isn't too certain of the reception his wife will give him. She knows nothing about his being here now." "No, Franklin specifically instructed his niece to say nothing to anyone. She did confide in her Uncle Gerald, the one who telephoned me." "Is Matilda Shore the forgiving kind?" Della Street asked. Mason grinned. "Definitely not. And reading between the lines of Helen Kendall's story, I'd say she's the most objectionable, peculiar character. What's more, there's an old love affair involved, too. The man is dead, but his son George Albert? Huh. He's the spitting image of his father, and Matilda is very much attached to him. I gather that Gerald Shore views the relationship with alarm. Well, why? In young Albert, Mason said, she sees the image of the man whom she once loved, her only living relatives being Gerald Shore and Helen Kendall. Originally and ordinarily, they'd be the beneficiaries under her will. Sometimes ago, before young Albert read Welcome on the mat, she intimated that they were not only her heirs, but would inherit the entire fortune. It is a fortune? Yes. Enter Albert. Mason grinned. Enter Albert. Gerald Shore thinks he's turning loose all of his charm, and there's no question about the fact that he has become a frequent visitor at the house. Good heavens, you don't mean that this woman of 64 is going to marry this? Probably not, but she wants her niece to marry him, and Albert seems to like the idea. Matilda Shore has become quite a despot, and she controls the purse strings. However, you haven't heard all the ramifications of the case yet. Not only was there this mysterious telephone call, but a kitten was poisoned this afternoon. Della raised her eyebrows. What has the poisoned kitten to do with the return of Franklin Shore? Perhaps nothing. Perhaps a lot. In what way? It was probably an inside job. Well, why inside? Because checking up as best they can, the cat doesn't seem to have been out of the house after 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The symptoms of the poisoning developed right around 5 o'clock. The veterinary says the poison was administered not over 15 or 20 minutes before the cat was brought to him for treatment. That was about 5:15. What kind of poison? Della asked. A kind that could have been administered to a human being? Well, that's the rub. Apparently, it was strychnine poisoning. Strychnine has a bitter taste. An animal would swallow it if the poison were skillfully embedded in small bits of meat, because animals seldom chew. But a human being would have been able to detect the bitter taste, particularly if the meat had been cooked. And you want me to go with you tonight? Yes. A man by the name of Leech is going to escort us to the place where Franklin is hiding. Why is he hiding? Mason laughed. Why did he disappear in the first place? I've often wondered about that, Della. Why a man who was enough of a realist to keep selling stocks short during the years which followed the crash of 29, who was making money hand over fist, who had everything that he wanted in life, should suddenly disappear and take none of the money with him? Perhaps he'd been salting something away, Della said. Not in these days of income tax. He might have falsified his books. An individual with a smaller income might have done that, but Franklin Shore's affairs were too complex. No, Della, we're in the way of solving an ancient mystery. The solution is going to be interesting and may be highly exciting. You want to get the picture of Matilda Shore as Helen Kendall painted it, a morose, strong-minded woman with over $1 million locked in her grasping hands, approaching the end of life, something of a Tartar. Addicted to chirping lovebirds, a servant who has always posed as a Korean, but who has acts and looks and talks just like a Japanese person. She's kept alive by one thing, the desire to be there waiting when her husband finally returns. Come on, Della. We're on the trail of another adventure in crime. Della grimaced. There's no crime yet, she pointed out. Well, Mason said, walking over to the hat closet and whipping on his coat, at least we have one attempted crime. Well, what's that? The kitten. The case of the poisoned kitten? She asked. She slipped a notebook and a half a dozen pencils into her purse and then stood by the desk as though worried about something. Coming? Demanded Perry impatiently. Chief, have you ever seen a kitten eat? Does a duck swim? Why? A cat usually picks at its food. The kitten must have been terribly hungry to gulp down those balls of meat. This kitten was just careless, I guess. Hurry up. Very careless, nodded Della. I think when I open the file for this case, I'll call it The Case of the Careless Kitten. Next week, we'll find out what Perry Mason finds when he goes to meet Uncle Franklin in The Case of the Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Gardner. We have time for one delightful story from Best Friends, Save Them All, Spring 2026 newsletter. Cuddle Puddle. What do you do when you have 7 scared schnauzers? Well, you give them a little life-saving magic, of course. When 7 schnauzers arrived at Best Friends Animal Sanctuary, we weren't exactly sure what they had been through, but it was clear they hadn't had an easy life. They were scared, shy, and needed emotional healing. So, of course, that's exactly what they got. Right away, caregivers began working with the pups to help them unwind. The dogs were hand-fed and spent quality time with people to help them build trust. They were given all kinds of treats, toys, and comfy beds to ease their anxiety. And soon, they were less stressed and ready for the next step in their journey. Families of their own. Of course, being that the schnauzers are very beloved dogs and oh so cute, they didn't have to wait long. Today, they all have homes. This article comes from the Spring 2026 newsletter of Best Friends, Save Them All. Well, that completes our readings for today. I do hope you've enjoyed them, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Until then, this is Joyce for Animal Companions and for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Be happy, everyone. Stay healthy. Be well. Bye-bye.